This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream. You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. On Saturday, December 5th, Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter hosted their annual Montreal Massacre Memorial event at the Vancouver Public Library. The event happens in congruence with the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women on December 6th, the anniversary of the murders of 14 women at L'École Polytechnique de Montréal in 1989. Also known as the Montreal Massacre. The following panel, moderated by Samantha Gray, was titled Creating Alternative Platforms for Feminist Analysis and includes a discussion of the kind of no-platforming and silencing of feminists that has become commonplace in recent years, as well as addresses the way in which some of us have been able to continue speaking out against male violence and oppression in the face of attacks. Lear Keith is the first speaker, I am the second. Lear Keith is a writer, small farmer, and radical feminist activist. She is the author of 6 books, including The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability, which has been called the most important ecological book of this generation. She is also co-author with Derek Jensen and Arik McBay of Deep Green Resistance, Strategy to Save the Planet. She's been arrested 6 times for acts of political resistance.
Okay, so a brief history of how we got here. 10,000 years ago, we're going to go fast. Patriarchy in various versions starts popping up around the globe, and bit by bit, it of course conquers the world. That's what patriarchy does. The only good thing to say about this is that wherever there is oppression, you will find resistance. There is some portion of us as a human collective that always refuses to submit. So one such resistance is, of course, the second wave of feminism. 1970 marks the publication of the book Sisterhood is Powerful, and at that point, the movement is well and truly launched. Women win and continue to win crucial victories. Legal abortion, rape shield laws, domestic violence shelters, the Nordic model. But just like there's always resistance, there is always backlash, and there are always collaborators. And what you hope is that the resistance is strong enough that the collaborators don't break your hearts completely. So in 1982, Ellen Willis invents this term, quote, sex-positive feminism, to distinguish herself from radical feminism. To this day, I cannot fathom what is positive about rape, torture, and slavery with a dose of capitalism thrown in for good measure. If you think that's hyperbole, I don't have slides today, but I urge you to go to Google and type in these 4 letters, P-O-R-N, right? Done to any other group of people, this would be recognized as a human rights horror. Done to women, it's good, clean, positive fun. All right. 1991, Rebecca Walker coins the term third wave feminism to describe this approach to women's oppression. It's kind of like feminism, except without the pesky feminism. One definition of third wave feminism, and this is their words, not mine, whether you decide as a woman to make your own aesthetic decisions and choices. Now, no man is told that his hopes and dreams, his moral agency, and indeed his humanity depends on what shoes he wears. And no oppressed man has ever been told that his liberation is about what he decides to wear. But even if we drop that word aesthetic, we're still left with a serious problem, that the best we can do is make the best choices we can. That's not liberation, that's capitulation. Now, in the words of Andrea Dworkin, feminism is the political practice of fighting male supremacy on behalf of women as a class. It really is just that simple. There's a group of people who are systematically hurt. You fight to change the material conditions. Not to make the best choice you can for yourself, to change those conditions. Dworkin named women's condition as the barricade of sexual terrorism. Rape, incest, battering, prostitution, pornography. Women are the people inside that barricade. Men are outside. In fact, men are building that barricade, fist by fist and fuck by fuck. That's how they create this class called women, and it's how they keep us there. Our job is to take that barricade down, brick by brick. for saying these simple things out loud, that women are a class and that women are oppressed. Radical feminists, myself included, have been deplatformed. Sometimes one speaker is targeted, and other times the entire event goes down. To give you an understanding of the level of threat and the kinds of threat, venues will be flooded with threats of arson. There are threats made against their employees and even the employees' children. At this point, they will cave, and you can hardly blame them. The venue may take no position at all on anything political. It's just a space that's rentable. But the moment their employees are up on the chopping block, they will back down, and so you lose your venue. That happened to, for instance, at the Irish Center in London, where an event called RadFem 2013 was supposed to take place. I was supposed to be a speaker. Sheila Jeffries was going to be a speaker. There were women coming from all over the world. And we lost our venue because of these kinds of threats of arson. I'll point out that the Irish Center has hosted the IRA publicly. They could not host radical feminists. Not because of what we say, let's be quite clear. Because of narcissistic, unbalanced, very entitled men who come after us with this kind of threat. So because of male violence, feminists are silenced. So that event was moved to another community center that held firm, but the building was surrounded by police inside and out for the entire day. If you had told me 30 years ago that someday to meet with other women to talk about rape and prostitution, we would be surrounded by an army of police officers to stay safe, I would not have believed you. But this has been my life now for the last 3 or 4 years. So that's the level of threat. Another example in Toronto, also in 2013, I was part of an organizing group. We put on an event called RadFem Rise Up, and the same thing happened. We lost our venue due to threats of arson and murder and whatever else. We found another venue really quickly. I mean, we lost our venue the day before, so this is a mad scramble. We ended up in a rental property, just like a big house, essentially, and we tried to have the event there. And these men were so persistent, they found somebody who was willing to socially engineer her way into our event, told them where we were. They, of course, turned up down the street. They had a protest against us. At least the police took it seriously, and they basically de-escalated the situation. But we were under siege. And the level of terror that some of these women felt, I'll never really forget that. There was one woman especially, she was living in a homeless shelter, escaping domestic violence. She had a 9-month-old baby, and she was a survivor of the sex industry. So she's the woman, you know, at 2 in the morning when you lie there thinking, why am I doing this work? She's the one, right? Everything has happened to her. And there she was. She found us. She found radical feminism. And she's sitting there with her baby, terrorized by these men. And all I could think was, it's going to take one asshole with a gun or somebody just, you know, off the rails enough that he's got a Molotov cocktail. We're never going to get out of this building alive. There's one exit. It's not meant to be a public venue. So I spend the entire time thinking, where is she? Where is that baby? Because if it's in my power, I'm getting her out that door when the worst happens. It hasn't happened yet. It's only a matter of time with this level of rhetoric. So the third example is, I mean, and I've got many, but the third example is I was supposed to be a keynote speaker at this huge environmental conference. The threat level against me was so outrageous that the administration stepped in and they hired 6 police officers to escort me around and keep me safe. So I had 4 uniformed officers and 2 plainclothes detectives to get me in and out of that building without somebody, I don't know, shooting me. The talk went really well, but it's kind of insane to have to talk under that level. Just of fear, and that's what we're up against. That's what's been happening out there. So I don't know anybody at this point who has not been deplatformed. This is every single one of my colleagues. Some of us, it's semi-constant, and for others, I can say just categorically, their careers have been destroyed by this. They'll never speak publicly again. So those are some lovely examples. Now, psychologists have actually come up with a phrase to name the psychology of the men who do these things, and they call it aggrieved entitlement. Okay, aggrieved entitlement. Mark Lapine had a lethal dose of aggrieved entitlement. So did Elliot Rodger. So do all the men who send these kinds of threats of arson and rape and death to silence us as feminists. The only good news is that it's not just feminists being targeted. There is an out-and-out mania right now for deplatforming on university campuses, and the left is doing it just as much as the right. The professors are scared. The administrations are giving into it. This has me deeply frightened for the future of civil rights and civic society. Universities are supposed to be the bulwark for basic values of a pluralistic democracy, and they are ushering in the end of those values by giving in. And I don't have a single colleague that hasn't experienced this. So what I know is that as long as patriarchy exists, women will fight back. And what I can promise you is that I'm not giving up. So One thing that I've done is I'm part of a group that formed 3 years ago. We named ourselves WOLF, which stands for the Women's Liberation Front. We are unapologetically radical feminists because we wanted to take this head on, and we will defend women's spaces until our dying breath. All oppressed people have a right to their own spaces. If we don't, think about what you're saying. What you're saying is that the oppressors have a right to constant access. Okay, that's what you're arguing. And if you don't hear the rape in that, you need to listen a little closer. So what women's spaces give us, respite from constant emotional, physical, and sexual subordination, the psychological liberation of women-identified values and practices, the creation of friendships and political community that is not possible if men are present, and a glimpse of true freedom. Another way to say this, poet Zaki Shange's most famous line, "I found God in myself, and I loved her fiercely." That is the experience that we can have in our own spaces. We become whole and we become holy. And what our oppressors know is that no one fights for a despised object, but your beloved, oh, you'll defend her to the death. So, WOLF, we have put on a bunch of really great events. We had an event called RadFems Respond in Portland, Oregon. We were deplatformed immediately. I will say that public libraries at least generally believe in free speech, so we were able to move the event to the public library there. It was a great event. You know, we did have plenty of security, but everything went well. We had another event that was called RadFem Rhapsody, and that happened last summer at Michigan Women's Music Festival. So we had a conference inside the festival that was for radical feminist topics. That also went really well. Last month at the Midwives Association of North America, there's a lot of debate going on right now there about language they're going to use, about who they actually serve, about the feminist framework they're going to keep or not. And some WOLF members put on a shadow conference there because they were utterly deplatformed, were not allowed to talk about feminism at all. Their materials were removed in the middle of the night. I mean, it was just insane. But they rented a suite and they had their own workshops and they presented information about feminism, and that went really well as well. But, you know, it's very scary to have to do these things. So, and then our final event is coming up next September. We are already planning an event that we're calling WOLF Festival, WOLF Fest, and that's going to be in Crescent City, California. And I know that that is a 12-hour drive for all of you, but that's 20 hours closer than Hart, Michigan. So I hope that you will all come. So, yeah, I'm not giving up, and I don't think any of you are either, so we're here for the fight. All right. Thank you.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about my experience doing writing and journalism as an actual feminist. And that experience has been revealing. I think I was a little naive when I embarked on that endeavor. And when I started blogging back in 2010, I wasn't really fully aware of how deep the divides between liberal and radical feminists were. And, you know, like as Lierre said, you know, like, I'm not exactly sure how to name those divides. You can call them third-wave feminists, sex-positive feminists, liberal feminists. But, you know, at the end of the day, I identify as a feminist and a socialist, and my analysis of violence against women and things like prostitution and pornography are rooted in radical feminism because there's no other analysis that makes sense. And there's no other analysis that centers women and that names the problem in an honest way. And so, while I often refer to those who refuse to make what are really obvious connections around various forms of violence against women as liberal feminists, my actual opinion is that those people who won't connect the dots between sexual assault, incest, domestic abuse, sexual harassment, objectification, femicide, pornography, prostitution, rape culture, porn culture, etc., are not in fact feminists. And they're not progressive. And you can't fight the status quo by framing it as empowerment, and you can't fight male violence without calling it male violence. So, you know, feminism is a real thing. It means something. It's a particular analysis. It's not whatever any individual says it is or whatever they want it to be. It's not inclusive. It's not everything. It's not everybody. So, you know, like, it's not this kind of watered down misogyny is empowerment thing that the liberal media, especially the American liberal media, pushes. It's not just the mainstream media. It's the liberal media. It's the progressive media. They're all kind of in cahoots on this. It's a real thing. It's a movement. It's political. It's what we call a woman-led fight to end patriarchy and male violence against women. So when I started writing about feminism, I didn't realize that I was really saying something that was very controversial. So I was writing about stuff like prostitution and pornography and sex and sexuality under patriarchy, the sexualization of domination and subordination, what some call BDSM, about objectification and the male gaze. And so I was connecting dots in a way that I thought was very obvious and plain. You know, sexualized violence is sexualized violence, power is power, patriarchy is real, simulated misogyny is still misogyny. And I was really shocked by the attacks that I experienced almost immediately. And I wasn't being attacked by the right. I wasn't even being attacked by, like, men's rights activists, or, you know, not by people who would call themselves men's rights activists. I was being attacked by people who thought they were sex-positive feminists and leftists and progressives. And it was totally weird, and it was like feminist analysis was so offensive to these people, and not only offensive, it was unspeakable. You couldn't say it. And so, at first, I think I thought it was like a big misunderstanding. Like I thought, if I can just explain this, like they obviously don't get it. So, I should have asked Leah. I don't think I knew her yet. They're all confused. It would, you know, it'd make sense to these people and they'd be like, oh, okay, you're right. And so it took me a while to realize that they didn't want to understand. And so arguing or explaining was futile in many cases, if not most cases. And understanding the impact of porn culture and objectification and the sex industry on women and girls was too much for them. It would disturb their worldview, and not just their worldview, but their social status and their careers. So they didn't want to understand. And they were, in fact, invested in misunderstanding and in projecting those misunderstandings into public discourse, in an intentional effort to manipulate that discourse. So, you know, now we're being told that women who name the objectification of women are actually doing the objectifying themselves. We're told that women who name pimps and johns as the abusers and exploiters of women in prostitution are responsible for that male violence that men are doing to women. Women who criticize the multi-billion dollar porn industry are enemies of the women working in that industry. You know, so it's like this, like, bizarro world feminism where black is white and up is down. But people are buying it, right? Like, and supposedly intelligent people, even people who say they care about women, people who care about other human rights issues, poverty, etc. So yeah, so I'd been blogging on my own website for a while I was working on my master's degree in women's studies at SFU. I was starting to get published a little bit. I was published in Horizons, which is a Canadian feminist magazine, and Ms. Magazine only because Robin Morgan, who's a radical feminist, still works there and is an editor there, and she reached out to me. And I noticed, especially because the Bedford case was going on during this time, I noticed that no one in the liberal media in the States, especially, was publishing feminist critiques of the sex industry, critiques of legalization or strong feminist critiques of porn. They weren't publishing anything about the Nordic model. And, you know, these were all publications that I was reading and that were dominating the conversation around feminism. So, like, Jezebel, Salon, Slate, RH Reality Check, Mike, XO Jane, even places like BuzzFeed, Bitch, Alternet, etc. And so I started pitching. And again, I just figured that maybe they weren't getting these kinds of pitches, or like they weren't aware of our work or of our movement. But, you know, it was just ignored. Or I would get a response that was like, this pitch doesn't really work for us, but they wouldn't say why. Jacobin, which is an American magazine that claims to be a leading voice of the American left, offering socialist perspectives on politics, economics, and culture, for example, actually told me — they shouldn't have told me this, but they told me — they wouldn't publish anything. They'd been publishing several articles that were pro-legalization by pro-industry lobbyists, and they said they wouldn't publish anything that responded to these articles because these people who were writing these articles, who are also editors at Jacobin, didn't like that idea. So, like, I'm sure they don't. But, you know, this is a socialist magazine. The Nordic model is a socialist model. It's ridiculous. And I kept trying, and I was successful in a few Canadian outlets. But, you know, the bigger American publications weren't interested, especially the liberal feminist ones, and they're nonstop publishing the same garbage over and over and over and over again by people who don't understand the Nordic model, who don't seem to understand feminism, who aren't experts on this material at all, and they're just regurgitating these mantras that they've read on Twitter or whatever. And they refuse to publish any real feminist critique. So what had happened was I realized that this was not just a fluke, it was intentional. And it was that sex industry lobbyists had taken leftist and feminist rallying calls and ideas and twisted them around in order to manipulate leftists and would-be feminists into believing that what they were doing when they were saying things like sex work is work or my body, my choice with regard to prostitution was very radical, when in fact they were working for pimps and johns and they themselves were industry lobbyists, whether or not they knew it. So they were upholding patriarchal, racist, capitalist, misogynist ideals and decontextualizing the sex industry, erasing the imperialist, colonialist, patriarchal, capitalist systems that invented and maintained the sex industry. And at the same time calling themselves feminists and leftists. So it wasn't a fluke that these pitches were being rejected, it was intentional. I'd been silently blackballed at all these publications that I was trying to get into because of my writing on prostitution and pornography. Like, it was nice to realize that I wasn't crazy, that this was like a real thing that was happening, but it was extremely disappointing and depressing. And, you know, like, I saw who was getting jobs at these places and who was getting columns and who was getting platforms at these big publications, and they were feminists, or they called themselves feminists, but they were women who refused to speak out against prostitution or pornography. And, you know, not only that, but I started to realize that I was being kept out of networks of women writers and journalists, and networks and groups that claimed to want to support women in journalism, and to promote female voices because of my politics. And I'll give you an example, but there's an invite-only Facebook group called Binders Full of Women Writers, and this is not just like a stupid little Facebook group. This is a group with 31,000 members, and it's connected to this big conference that happens annually in the U.S. called BinderCon, which is a professional development conference designed to empower women and gender non-conforming writers with the tools, connections, and strategies they need to advance their careers. And the purpose of this particular group is to allow writers to network and exchange tips and to expand the number of female writers published across the industry. Yet, somehow, mysteriously, I, out of all these 31,000 women writers, was excluded from this group. And again, like, I kind of was like, okay, I'm not gonna make any assumptions here. You know, it did seem pretty weird. Like, every single female writer and feminist writer was involved in these groups and networks and organizations, but for some mysterious reason, I was not. And when I, like, tested my theory and I asked a friend to try to add me, and, you know, like, I was intentionally kept out, and I figured out why when I looked into it. So the admin and the founder of this group is a woman named Lux Altron, who's an Ivy League graduate, and she had been the CEO, owner, and editor of a porn blog called Fleshbot. So she was the one responsible for this entire network and for this conference. She sold this blog and presumably made a bunch of money off of it. And she's an outspoken pro-porn and prostitution advocate. And it's not just about jobs. It's not just about whether, like, actual feminist writers and journalists can get jobs and make money. Like, they can't, really, or it's hard anyway. But, like, it's about what kind of analysis is out there and who's allowed to speak and whose voices are heard and whose stories are told and what the parameters of discourse are. And all of liberal American media is like this. So the women who are getting published and getting jobs are all friends, but they also all share the same politics and they kind of toe the party line. And, like, it's disappointing because it's no different, or it's not, you know, like, there's an old boys club in journalism and in many other industries, and there has been for a long time, and now women are doing the same thing to each other, you know, keeping people out of networks, keeping people out of jobs, not helping women based on their politics or friends or what they say. And there are similar problems in Canada, but on a much smaller scale. And it seems centered in Toronto for some reason. There's a very male-centered activist circle in Toronto that seems to dominate feminist discourse as well. And, you know, in Canada, the problem is different in that there's just so few places to even pitch to. Like, there's so few places even to get published, and nobody has any money. So if you do want to kind of make it, you do have to go outside the country. I have no choice but to maintain my own platform, because there's nowhere else to put this stuff. Literally, there's nowhere else to put it. And that's not a bad thing. Like, I feel very lucky to have Feminist Current as a space, thank God. I don't have a boss. Like, my boss is the movement, which is a good thing. I'm accountable to the movement, not to someone who's paying me. And, you know, like, as much as the reasons that we're forced to create our own media and our own media platforms are really disturbing reasons and really unethical reasons and really depressing reasons, like, having this platform is really amazing. And, you know, myself and the women who contribute, which are from all across the world and are women from all different ages, older feminists, younger feminists, women from different backgrounds, they're putting themselves on the line. And they're writing themselves out of media jobs and out of social circles and out of activist circles and out of these networks. And, I mean, that we're even able to have this platform is amazing. And it's only because of support from, you know, like our sisters and brothers and from our readers and from each other. So, you know, it's been very difficult. And it's been a fight. And it will continue to be a fight and a struggle because people are cowardly, and they're afraid of change, and they're looking out for number one, which makes sense. We're living in a neoliberal society, and people are often forced to look out for number one. You know, and like it was mentioned earlier that there was a petition to have me fired from my very tiny editing job at Rabble and to have me deplatformed. And I cross-post my blog there, and I put my podcast up there for free. I do that voluntarily. So they're trying to get me fired from an unpaid position as well. And this is something, like Liara said, this has happened to every single woman who's become well-known enough and who's seen as a threat to this pro-porn, pro-prostitution, pro-patriarchy rhetoric. And it will keep happening. But, like, I think what's worth remembering, and a positive thing, is that the reason that they do this, and the reason why they're so desperate to shut us down and shut us up and, you know, keep us poor and quiet, is because they're losing. And they see the women's movement, the real women's movement, they see it gaining momentum, and they see it gaining supporters, and we're, you know, there's successes, and they feel threatened. And their empty mantras aren't working. And their, you know, like, underhanded, unethical tactics and their lies and their smear campaigns, they're not working. And we're growing, not shrinking. And, you know, like, and it looks bad. Like, it's a bad look. Like, they, what they're doing, people are seeing it, and they see that, you know, like, it's like, do not have a good enough argument that you have to lie? Because we aren't lying. Like, all we're doing is telling the truth. And that's making them so angry. The truth is such a huge threat. So, you know, it makes them look like shady people because they're shady people. Like, and they see that we don't have to do that. We don't have to lie. We have strong arguments. And we don't have to get people fired or no platformed. It's not what we do. And, you know, all we're doing is telling the truth. And what we're saying makes sense. And we're right and they're wrong. So that's what we have.
That's a t-shirt. They're right in there. Speaking of t-shirts, Megan's website, Feminist Current, if you have money, after you stay here all day and after you read Ripley's website, go and donate.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
You just heard audio from a panel held at Vancouver Public Library on December 5th, 2015. The panel was titled Creating Alternative Platforms for Feminist Analysis and was organized by Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter as part of their annual Montreal Massacre Memorial event. Speakers included myself, Lear Keith, Hilla Kerner, a Vancouver Rape Relief Collective member, and the panel was moderated by Samantha Gray, also a collective member at Vancouver Rape Relief. For more information on Lierre's work, visit Lierre Keith, LIERREKEITH.com. And for more information on the event and on Vancouver Rape Relief, visit raperelieffshelter.bc.ca. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com. Come on.